In mid-2009, Malcolm Turnbull's leadership was in trouble. He'd been relying on a mole from Treasury with the Dickensian name of Godwin Greck, and Greck's leaks had, up until that point, proven absolutely faithful. But then he overreached, fabricated an email that caused Turnbull to accuse the Prime Minister of lying and corruption in Parliament, and when it was revealed, Turnbull suffered the biggest fall in his personal approval ratings than the pollsters had ever seen. Fast forward a couple of months, and the moves against Turnbull were well underway. As he set to position himself as a potential leadership contender, Joe Hockey decided that to deal with his position on climate change, he would put out a tweet. "Hey gang, on re the ETS, keen to get your views." The spectacle of a senior politician putting an issue as serious as climate change out to the Twitterati caused Hockey's stakes to fall. 3 days later, a group of senior Liberals get together. It's the 30th of November and they decide that one of them, Joe Hockey, will run against Malcolm Turnbull. As the meeting breaks up, one of the participants, Tony Abbott, puts his hand on the door and says, "Well, actually, I will run. Sorry," and leaves. The next day is the ballot. It's an unseasonably cold day in Canberra, and most of the members of the Liberal Party room are there. But one who is not is a Malcolm Turnbull supporter by the name of Fran Bailey. She's had gone to see her doctor the previous weekend, who said she needs an MRI scan and recommends against her travelling to Canberra. Turnbull is therefore down one number and finally loses the ballot 41 votes to 42. Had any of those five pieces of luck, Godwin Greck, Joe Hockey's tweet, Tony Abbott's moment with his hand on the door handle, or Fran Bailey's MRI scan gone the other way, it's entirely possible Malcolm Turnbull would have remained leader of the Liberal Party and would be Australia's Prime Minister today. Luck is events that are outside your control and outside your understanding. In 1588, the Spanish decide they will put together a naval expedition to invade England. They call it the Invincible Armada. But as it crosses the English Channel, the Invincible Armada are hit by a freak storm, which wipes out a third of the ships, destroys their chances of successfully invading England, and suggests, by the way, that if you're thinking yourself about putting together a flotilla of ships, the name Invincible is probably not the optimal tag. Luck has affected other conflicts as well. On the 28th of June, 1914, an assassination team waits in the streets of Sarajevo for Archduke Franz Ferdinand. They take a half-hearted attempt to kill him, but fail. Thinking that they're out of danger, the chauffeur drives a little further and then takes a wrong turn down a narrow street. Waiting on that narrow street is a member of the assassination team, Gavrilo Princip. When he steps up to the car, the chauffeur has nowhere to go. The street is too narrow. He fires two shots and kills the Archduke. That provides the pretext that Austria needs to declare war on Serbia, and World War I follows. Luck, too, struck in World War II. At the end of the war, the Americans decide that they will take the extraordinary decision of dropping a nuclear bomb in Japan. They drop the first bomb and Hiroshima. And they plan then, a few days later, to drop the second bomb on the city of Kokura. But the cloud cover above Kokura that day is too thick. The American bombers don't feel they can see their targets. So they radio back and are told they should go to the second target, a city called Nagasaki. The death toll that day in Nagasaki is somewhere between 40,000 and 80,000. Because it's a bigger city than Kokura, it's likely that around 10,000 more people died on that day than had there not been excess cloud cover. During World War II as well, there are moments of luck that affect combatants and non-combatants. One of the most famous ships to bring migrants to Australia is the Dunera, which brings a group of young Jewish refugees, including Fred Gruen, who was one of my predecessors as head of the economics program in the Research School of Social Sciences. Australian academia is greatly enriched by the Dunera boys, but that might never have happened had the torpedo that was fired at the side of the Dunera exploded when it struck. As Bruce Chapman acknowledged in paying tribute to Fred Gruen's life and the work of his sons, Nicholas and David, we're all here much more fortunate for the incompetence of a German torpedo maker. And indeed, luck has shaped Australia's very colonial foundings. In 1770, James Cook's ship, travelling up past the Barrier Reef, struck coral. There was horror on board until it was realised that the chunk of coral had not only pierced a hole in the hull, but it also come off and was acting like a sort of a plug, stopping the water from flowing in. It provided Cook's men time to fix the hull and managed to sail the ship on further. In the 1780s, La Perouse wasn't quite so lucky. His ship struck coral in Micronesia and was sunk, killing all on board. But for slight differences in those two coral accidents, we might be having this conversation in French rather than English today. Luck matters too in sport. If you look at the NBA, it now features twice as many players who are more than 7 foot tall as it did a couple of decades ago. And while basketballers are getting taller, top gymnasts are getting shorter. Top female gymnasts used to have an average height of 5 foot three. Now that's 4 foot nine. We also see changes not just in height, but in their very dimensions. Most of us are square, meaning if you measure us head to foot, you get about the same number as if you measure us fingertip to fingertip. But not NBA players, because they're selected on whether their body type can reach the ring. NBA players tend to be wider than they are tall. Swimmers, for their part, tend to have long torsos and stumpy legs. Your chances of making the Olympics, if you don't have the right genetic luck, are smaller than ever before. Now, as you've heard, not everything in politics is luck. But I believe that understanding luck allows you to watch politics in colour rather than in black and white. It's not that black and white picture doesn't tell you a lot. I grew up as a kid watching a black and white TV. But it's that when you understand luck, you see a fuller picture as to what's going on in politics. And it isn't just that it makes the understanding of politics more nuanced, more interesting. It's also that luck's a really fundamental concept for progressives, for anyone who believes in egalitarianism. An understanding of luck is why we have a public healthcare system. It's why we have a social safety net. We provide unemployment benefits to people who are unlucky enough to lose their jobs. An understanding of luck is a recognition that the shafts of fate can strike any of us at any time. Sometimes what looks like bad luck can turn out to be good. John Howard ran for a state seat of Des Moines in 1968 and missed out by a mere 420 votes, just 1/50th of the electorate. As Howard later reflected to me in an interview, he was incredibly fortunate in missing out because it then allowed him to run for the federal seat of Bennelong in 1974. He also reminded me that the same bad luck which turned into good had happened to Gough Whitlam when he ran for the state seat of Sutherland in 1950, missing out by 456 votes, about that same 2% margin that Howard missed out on. Whitlam also ran for local government, prompting him to say at one point that I could have been Lord Mayor of Sydney, Premier of New South Wales, or president of the Sutherland Shire. Alas, the fates were against me. One's entry into politics can often have an element of randomness as well. When Joe Hockey ran for the seat of North Sydney, he found himself running in a race in which there was no popular independent, because the independent member for North Sydney, Ted Mack, had retired in 1996. Why did Ted Mack retire? Well, he retired from the federal parliament for the same reason he'd retired from the state parliament. He believed in principle that the defined benefit superannuation schemes, which I hasten to say do not apply to Katie or myself, were out of kilter with community standards. And he wanted to retire just before he was eligible for one. Had Ted Mack not retired at that point, it's near impossible to imagine that Joe Hockey might have beaten him. When he ran for pre-selection for the seat of Cook in 2007, Scott Morrison was eliminated in the first round ballot. There were 150 voters. Scott Morrison got 8 votes. The eventual winner was a candidate by the name of Michael Tauck. But in the days after the ballot, information started to come out about Tauck, about the security firm that he'd run, and the New South Wales Liberal executive talked about whether perhaps they should disendorse him and run the pre-selection again. The numbers were as finely balanced as they could be. And finally, the Liberal Party executive voted by 11-9 to overturn the pre-selection result. Morrison ran the next pre-selection and beat businessman Peter Tynan to become the member for Cook. Paul Keating, Malcolm Turnbull, Brian Howe and Gough Whitlam all won their pre-selections with less than 60% of the vote. Sometimes one person's tragedy can be another person's career starter. In 1936, 4 Spanish generals staged a coup against the government. Their leader was a man by the name of José Sanjurjo, who got ready to fly from France back to Spain to take up his role as head of the nation. When the pilot queried the number of large trunks of clothing that he was planning to put on board this small plane, Sanjurjo told him very grandly, "I need to have these clothes if I am to be attired as the new Cadillo of Spain." The weight brought the plane down, killing Sanjurjo. In his place, Franco ruled Spain with an iron fist in the ensuing decades. In 1953, the Victorian Liberal leader, Trevor Oldham, flew to Britain to represent his party in the coronation of Queen Elizabeth II. His plane crashed, killing Oldham. In his place, Henry Bolte stepped in. The next year, the Victorian Labor Party split, lost office, and Bolte became Premier for the next 17 years. But for a plane crash, it's easy to imagine that when you visit Melbourne, you might be driving across the Oldham Bridge rather than the Bolte Bridge. In 1968, Jack Pizzey, the leader of the Queensland National Party, had a sudden heart attack. Joe Bjelke-Petersen took up the leadership and became Queensland's longest-serving Premier for 21 years. And then there's assassinations. The leading study of assassinations, and yes, there are economists that study political assassinations, estimates that about 1 in 5 succeed, which I find somewhat heartening, I have to say. One of those that failed was the man who took a shot at Teddy Roosevelt in 1912. Roosevelt was about to deliver a speech, and luckily for him, it was a very long speech. A 40-page speech folded in his breast pocket helped stop the assassin's bullet and allow Teddy Roosevelt to survive. Yitzhak Rabin was not so fortunate in 1995. An assassin stepped up, fired 3 bullets from his Beretta pistol, 2 of which struck Rabin, killing him. Rabin was unlucky in that the shots found their mark, but unlucky too in that his security detail had been far more focused on the threats from a potential Palestinian assassin than from someone like Yigal Amir from the Israeli far right. This isn't just a story of careers. One can imagine that the Palestinian-Israeli peace process would have followed a very different route, but for the assassination of Rabin. As you've heard, there's a little number crunching in the book. My party leader has been talking about the need for all students to learn coding, and this book was my way of continuing to put my coding skills to use. I've estimated that being top of the ballot can be worth an extra percentage point, which has made a difference for a range of political candidates over the years, including Andrew Lamming, Kim Beazley, and in 2010, Michelle Rowland. I estimate that candidates who are better looking garner more votes, a result which turns out to be quite surprising for those who've ever watched Parliament and wondered, is this the best you can do? To which I can only respond, you should have seen the ones who missed out. I estimate that there is an effect of first name popularity. Psychologists who study first names find that there's a tendency for us to be drawn to the familiar. As one researcher summarises the results, Toby is more likely to drive a Toyota, move to Toronto and marry Tonya. Jack is more likely to drive a Jaguar, live in Jacksonville and marry Jackie. So it's not so surprising that those who have popular first names, such as David or Peter, Jennifer or Sarah, score one percentage point more votes than those with rare names, such as Tobias, Nina, Gina or Gareth. Having a short surname matters as well. Add 10 characters to your surname and you take one percentage point off the vote, which may explain why Concetta Fioravanti Wells serves in the Senate rather than in the House. There's luck of your parents as well. If your parent was a federal member of parliament, you are 354 times more likely to yourself serve in the federal parliament, a dynastic effect which exceeds anything that I can estimate for any other occupations. And indeed, there's even effect of the weather on polling day. If you're an incumbent, you want rain and cool weather. Each of those boosts your chances of re-election by nearly 2 percentage points. Cool rainforest conditions are good for those hoping to get another chance for the voters, but if you're a challenger hoping to oust the incumbent party, you want desert-like conditions, hot and dry, that boil the blood, and seem to see incumbents ousted more often. Luck can be cute, but luck has a deeper meaning too. As the baseball saying goes, some people are born on third base thinking they hit a triple. One study by the World Bank estimates that 4/5 of the income variation we see around the globe is due to the luck of the country you're born in and the luck of the parents to whom you're born. Unless you think you chose your country of birth or you chose your parents, then 4/5 of the variation between you and other people in the world is due to luck. Yes, hard work matters, but a lazy Norwegian is very likely to earn more than a hard-working Nepalese. Luck, too, is important for our understanding of politics. In entrepreneurship, they have notions of failing fast and failing smart. There's Silicon Valley entrepreneurs who'll take the name of their first failed company and put it on their personalised number plate to remind themselves of the lessons that they learned from failure. Successful politicians have sometimes had an early stint of failure in their careers. Robert Menzies, our longest-serving Prime Minister, had an unsuccessful period of leading his party. John Howard, our second longest-serving Prime Minister, also had an unsuccessful stint of leading his party. Both reflected on how that early failure helped them to be better leaders. If we're too quick to to kick the unsuccessful into the gutter, then we miss out on the lessons that can come from luck. 500 years ago, Machiavelli said that about half of the outcomes in politics are luck. I'm no good at estimating precisely what the figure is today, but Machiavelli's benchmark strikes me as roughly right. Putting luck into politics makes us less likely to revere the successful or revile the unsuccessful. It gives us, I hope, a more enlightened notion of what's going on in politics and can perhaps too help us build a gentler politics. Thank you for coming along tonight and for giving me the great good fortune of your presence. I look forward to the questions.